Welcome to the Eastern Shore Journal with Tom Herz, a podcast dedicated to the Eastern Shore, its traditions, and the people who live here. We all live here for our own reasons. Some of us are born here and perhaps have deep and storied roots. Some of us have come here to retire and enjoy a peaceful life. Others have come here to raise a family and achieve a balance that's hard to achieve in other mid-Atlantic areas. For me, I came here for the third reason, to achieve some level of balance. I'm a software developer and technical project manager, and I found that I was working 14 and 15-hour days on software projects with little or no quality of life. And once I found the Eastern Shore, and specifically Chestertown, I realized that I could have both my cake and eat it too. I could work on technical projects, but I could also enjoy what the Eastern Shore has to offer, which is great outdoor spaces, lovely people, and deep traditions. I'd like to share some of those conversations with you.
The Eastern Shore Journal, produced in cooperation with Hometown Multimedia.
Welcome to Eastern Shore Journal with Tom Herz. This is Tom Herz, a podcast about the Eastern Shore. As you may recall from previous episodes, we are exploring what makes the Eastern Shore so wonderful and such a great place to live. Today, we've got Annie Richards, our newly minted Chester Riverkeeper. Welcome to the show, Annie.
Thank you.
By way of introduction, Annie Richards has spent her childhood along the Chester River and has since held a lifelong love of the landscape, culture, and community of the Chester River and the Greater Eastern Shore. She has a BA in English Literature and a minor in Anthropology from Roger Williams University. She lives just outside Chestertown with her husband, son, and Irish setter. The four can often be seen cruising around on the Chester River in their launch, Old Pharaoh. And I have to ask, Annie, what is Old Pharaoh?
So Old Pharaoh is a handybilly design. It's just a little launch that we acquired a few years ago. But the name Old Pharaoh is actually a kind of a slang reference to a one-cylinder engine that watermen traditionally used in their bateaux around the Chester River and other tributaries in the Chesapeake back in the 40s and 50s.
Okay. Well, thanks for the context.
Yeah.
So you've worked at Echo Hill managing their fleet of historic Chesapeake Bay workboats, and you've provided students of all ages with outdoor education-centered ecology lessons. It just goes on and on. And so as the Chester Riverkeeper, you're dedicating your career and your life to restoring the river's natural resources and cultivating a stronger and healthier more accessible waterway for us all. So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, it's been just a pleasure since I started about a month ago. And, as you mentioned, I grew up here and I spent so much of my career on the education side of Chesapeake Bay, kind of stewardism. And it was an amazing place to grow my own education level and teaching others. But what I really appreciated about that part of my life was that the type of education work that I was doing kind of occupied this middle space between ecology and also interacting with the stakeholders around the Chesapeake and honoring their traditions and cultures and deep history and their perspective that comes out of all of that. And, you know, it kind of sought to build a bridge between the science that we know needs to occur to restore our waterways, while also making sure that we're honoring all these stakeholders along the way. And so now to step into this Chester Riverkeeper role as an advocate and a policy influencer is just an awesome way to kind of bring that experience from the education and interaction side to a place where hopefully, you know, I can make some impactful change.
So then you're the Chester Riverkeeper, but you work for an organization called Shore Rivers, or your position is funded through Shore Rivers. How does that work?
So absolutely. Shore Rivers is my employer and the position is funded and housed under Shore Rivers. The concept of a riverkeeper and kind of my title as a riverkeeper is given to me through the Waterkeepers Alliance, which originally started on the Hudson in New York. And since that kind of first concept of a river keeper existed in the Hudson battling polluters from 1970 till now, we have 350 water keepers worldwide. And the Water Keepers Alliance essentially has a list of requirements for you to qualify as a river keeper or water keeper. And that is, you have to live inside the watershed that you protect. You have to have a boat and you have to work full time. And then associated with that are various conferences and information sessions and, you know, outreach programs that I can access to kind of further, you know, my reach and collaboration with other water keepers and then my continuing education. But the way that, you know, actual river keeper positions work is typically they're funded by a community or funded by a nonprofit organization. So I don't necessarily answer to the Water Keepers Alliance. They're just a resource and kind of the original organization that kind of coined the term.
Okay, so then your local entry point would be Shore Rivers. And just for those listening, Shore Rivers is an organization with a vision of healthy waterways across Maryland's Eastern Shore. And the mission, their stated mission statement is protecting, restoring Eastern Shore waterways through science-based advocacy, restoration, and education. So you're sort of the tip of the spear in that vision and that mission. Would you agree?
Yeah. You know, so Shore Rivers is this kind of amazing culminating result of a lot of really involved communities and grassroots initiatives. You know, about 3 years ago is when Shore Rivers became fully formed, and it was the result of a merger between Chester River Association, Sassafras River Association, and the Midshore River Conservancy. And so since that merger, our programs have been, you know, able to get stronger than ever, and we've been able to diversify more. So yes, there are four river keepers within Shore Rivers for the Choptank, Miles Y River, Sassafras River, and Chester. There's also a ag department, and we also have an education department and a community outreach department. So, you know, to say that I'm the tip of the spear for advocacy, definitely. Advocacy is, you know, the river keeper's purview. We're the voice for the river. We're kind of representing the river's interests in anything and everything, whether it's relating with the community, whether it's in local policy and politics, whether it's state level policy and politics, or, you know, kind of collaborating with other departments to help achieve river-friendly goals. So that could be that I'm meeting with a farmer alongside some of our ag team staff to, you know, discuss with them a possibility of putting in a restoration project on their fields. It could be me meeting with a homeowners association who is interested in implementing river-friendly yard practices in their community so they can better steward a stream that might be running behind their neighborhood. It could also be me meeting with a group of students on a class at Kent School or, you know, any other group of students in the watershed that is interested in learning more about Chester River ecology and, you know, everything that's at stake that goes into determining, you know, its future and how we access it.
So let's just cut to it then. What would you say, in your estimation, is the state of the Chester River? Is it in good health? Is it bad health?
Well, I think that's, you certainly couldn't put it in black and white terms because, you know, I want to be clear that Shore Rivers functions with science first. So we are constantly collecting, you know, a series of data yearly, monthly, weekly, that it can help us to determine the health of the river. And we're always going toward a goal of a cleaner, healthier, more accessible river for everyone. And that work's never going to be over. You know, I think if you go and look at a lot of videos online of river keepers, they often say that their goal is to put themselves out of a job, you know, which is true. We would love for these rivers to be so clean and so well protected that there is no need for this. But we all know also that, you know, our work will never be finished because, you know, the world is growing. There's always going to be a need for expansion, and expansion, you know, takes its toll on the environment. And so there are kind of forces and effects that we're always going to have to mitigate and reevaluate and restore. So, you know, the Chester River to put it in my own personal terms, aside from data, you know, when I was a kid, you used to be able to go water skiing. And when you went water skiing, the prop on your boat would get clogged from SAV and various bay grasses that were growing here in the river. And that certainly doesn't happen anymore. Now there is SAV return to the river, and there's a lot of efforts being put forward to protect those beds, expand those beds. In fact, we just got a grant where we're going to be working with CES at Washington College. We have this brand new mechanism called a turbulator, and we're going to be able to harvest SAVs from established beds and use this turbulator to extract the seeds. And that way we'll be able to plant new beds along the river. But SAVs and other, you know, grasses contributing to ecosystems and water quality, you know, we need to see way more of that. We need to have a much less turbid river with less sediment running in. Our nitrogen loads, our phosphorus loads all need to be lowered. You know, every river advocacy organization in the Bay right now is working toward helping their region achieve the required nutrient and phosphorus load reductions associated with a statewide initiative to reduce those levels statewide. And that's usually referred to as the TMDL, which is the total maximum daily load. So, you know, we're always working toward reducing all of the nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment runoff that's coming into the bay. And as that occurs, there'll be less oxygen dead zones. There'll be more high quality visibility, which leads to better grass growth, more habitat, more for species to propagate. And then, of course, it also results in less bacteria, which is, you know, less bacteria in the water is a really positive thing for us as humans who are recreating in the water. I mean, bacteria can be a real health hazard, and human health is a huge concern for us. And the bacteria associated in the water, we're looking to reduce that significantly. And so all of this is an ongoing effort, and, you know, the work's never going to be done.
Sure. So then let's take two pieces of that. You know, so when you talked about phosphorus and nitrogen loads in the water, I heard agriculture. Now that might not be right. I don't know. And then in terms of overall health and well-being of the river long term, what I heard was environmental education. Right. So let's take that. Let's take that first topic first. When you say nitrogen and phosphorus loads, is the chief contributor there agricultural practices, and how does the riverkeeper help impact those practices, if it is indeed the cause, in a positive way?
Sure. So yes, agriculture is a key contributor to nitrogen and phosphorus loads. And because the Eastern Shore of Maryland is so intensely agrarian and agricultural, a lot of the statewide nitrogen phosphorus levels that need to be lowered is gonna be, you know, as a result of efforts we're making in ag. And we are making a lot of gains. In installations of buffers, bioretention basins that, you know, capture runoff before it hits the river, and then it's allowed to slowly filter through the ground and through various native plants before it's discharged into the river to absorb some of that excess nutrients, is a huge gain.
So let me just interrupt you there. So a buffer zone on the farm itself as it abuts the river, is that what you mean?
A buffer zone would be, so if you imagine if you're 100% agriculture on your property, and you farm all the way up to the edges of your property, there is no buffer between you and the next person, or if you happen to be a waterfront farm, between you and, you know, the river or whatever tributary to the river you may live by. By installing a buffer, and that could be a specific amount of grassland, it could be a hedgerow of shrubs or trees, but essentially anything that is not getting sprayed, not getting tilled, not having any kind of nutrients amended in the soil, and is just an area where there are established plants that can absorb the rainwater runoff that's going across that tilled or amended land. before it hits a water source.
Okay, so then your role really is to be present with those farming communities and those farmers to help them understand what's possible, what helps benefit the river, what helps benefit the watershed, and generally just sort of restore, I guess, balance to the equation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's just the farms are just one piece of that equation for the balance. You know, I would say more importantly, my job is to kind of identify farmers who are already doing this, because what's amazing about soil health and water quality is that polluted rivers are a symptom of land management. And so when you have healthy soil, you are going to have healthier rivers. And consequently, when you have healthy soil, you're also going to have high crop yields and efficiency. So, you know, farmers and environmentalists who are seeking to, you know, increase water quality, I think have in the past been construed to be on opposite sides of the coin. But really what we want is the same thing. And so the conversations that are happening now and really in the last 10 to 15 years are really exciting because, you know, we're starting to collaborate and see all this new science. And, you know, there are so many farmers in Kent, Queen Anne's County who are no-till farming, which, you know, there's been some kind of publishing and sharing of some videos associated with the million acre challenge. And that is a challenge that, you know, for Maryland, they're trying to see a lot more no-till farming because it is so beneficial for mitigating runoff into the bay. But you'll also talk to a lot of farmers here in Kent and Queen Anne's County who did it purely for monetary reasons. And it was, you know, a great decision for them. It increased their crop yield. It cut down on the time they had to spend tilling and prepping beds. So, you know, there's a lot of conversations still to go and restoration projects that we are so excited to help, you know, farmers and collaborate with them on. But, you know, these conversations and pathways to kind of aligning land stewardship and water quality is already happening. And it's just a question of, you know, a timeline.
So, you know, that leads into the question of environmental education. And when I say those two words together, where my mind goes are young kids, you know, either sailing on the Sultana or having access to the water and doing environmental classes at Echo Hill. But I also I'm regularly reminded that education in the ag space is more and more towards sustainable practices, right? In fact, I just had a conversation with a dairy farmer 2 days ago, and he was basically saying that farms fall into four categories. There's you know, the big producers, there's kind of medium-sized you know, progressive dairies or farms. Then there's, you know, smaller sort of centers of excellence where they're doing everything exactly right or doing their very best to do exactly right. And then there are family farms or legacy farms that haven't necessarily invested in upgrades to their equipment and upgrades to their farming practices, or maybe just have an old or outdated or comfortable sense of how they farm their land. But the next generation coming up isn't learning those practices. They're going to, say, University of Maryland and getting a degree in various environmental practices, various farming practices. Do you work with any of those organizations like the University of Maryland or other sources of education to educate the next generation of farmers?
So, I mean, in my experience, personally, I have yet to be able to engage in that kind of education level, but I would absolutely be excited to do that. You know, we obviously partner a great deal with Washington College and CES, and, you know, Washington College is doing some incredibly kind of forward-thinking and sustainable, diverse agriculture practices with Chino Farms.
And let me just interrupt you for 1 second. Excuse me. What is CES, just for their listeners?
Sure. CES is the Center for Environment and Society. which is a learning center associated with Washington College. Chesapeake Semester is a part of CES, as well as a multitude of other learning platforms, and there's a couple of science labs, and essentially it houses the environmental studies
department. And that's that lovely building right on the Chester River.
Exactly.
So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, please.
That's right. So, with Washington College's acquisition of Chino Farms, they've been able to demonstrate a lot of different diverse land management tactics, kind of in tandem with traditional monoculture grain rotation crop farming. And so, we're definitely looking to partner more with organizations and education institutions that can kind of help steward those conversations forward. And, I am participating right now in the Queen Anne's County Comprehensive Plan Update process, which is all a series of Zoom workshops. And something I've been advocating for a lot is for, as much as everyone wants Queen Anne's County to focus on the preservation of agriculture land, which I 100% agree on, I also am looking for the county to incentivize agriculture diversity and make sure that there are resources available for the next generation of farmers to learn all they can about how they can best steward their land and get the most from their soil health, which is in turn going to be a positive thing for Chester.
So let's talk a little bit about water quality, right? And I think we've touched on nitrogen and phosphorus levels. We've touched on education, but there's other impacts to that as well. And one of those is stormwater runoff, right? Can you talk a little bit about what stormwater can do to our river in a detrimental way?
Absolutely. So I think this is a really interesting topic for the Chester River, especially in the setting of your podcast of why is Kent County, why is the Eastern Shore this, special place to live? And part of that is its kind of historical roots and all of the colonial characteristics that are protected and maintained here. And Chestertown is such an amazing example of that. And we also still have an example of what a colonial stormwater management system looks like, which is to have all of the roads and gutters and sidewalks shaped in such a way that people's wastewater that was getting dumped into the streets would be shot from the town as quickly as possible down into the river, which at the time that, that was happening, the river was a lot different in terms of its water quality standards than it is now. And so now stormwater management has evolved significantly, but as it's incredibly expensive and it's a big hurdle for small towns, small rural towns to produce the funds that are necessary to put in retrofits in a historic town. I know that this is a big hurdle for towns like Chestertown and Chestertown specifically. So organizations like Shore Rivers are, really energized to help collaborate, produce funding for stormwater retrofits that can help reduce, runoff over impermeable surfaces. And when that happens, we get something that's called the island effect. So on a hot day, the temperature of the tarmac or the temperature of the pavement is going to heat up the water significantly. And so on a big thunderstorm, which happened more and more thanks to climate change, when we have a large thunderstorm rain event in the middle of the summer, and we have just inches and inches of rainfall shooting down High Street into the Chester River, all of that water is getting heated significantly from the warming effects. And when that stormwater runoff hits the Chester, it's going to raise the temperature of the river in that zone very significantly. And that's going to harm all the life that exists right there. And that's going to affect oxygen levels, SAVs, any fish that are there, any other life that's there. So, as the warming of the river occurs, that also is going to promote more algal blooms. So, reducing that island effect is one really important thing to do. But also, bacteria is another kind of side effect of having stormwater runoff hitting our rivers. And so one way that we can mitigate that is by disrupting the you know, pattern of pavement that we have in towns and municipalities and adding more green space. Because when we have more green space and permeable surfaces, we can start to add retrofits like bioretention basins, which is a, you know, the similar technology that I was referring to with agriculture restoration efforts. We can also establish much expanded canopy zones within towns. So the more tree canopy we have, the more shade that's cooling the permeable, the impermeable surface that we have, that's going to positively affect what runoff is coming down off the streets. So there are a lot of different ways that we can start to mitigate stormwater runoff. And, you know, Shorers is really energized to help Chestertown achieve that because, you know, we're at this really exciting point of the Biden administration where, you know, in the next 4 years, there could be over $1 billion going into the Delmarva to prepare them for resiliency against climate change and, you know, providing infrastructure. And, you know, so this is the time to be thinking big and thinking collaboratively across municipalities, across counties, and across organizations. So you mentioned you'd spoken to Owen Bailey earlier, you know, with Eastern Shore Land Conservancy's Open Streets program. You know, it's a great opportunity to be merging and collaborating and saying, okay, if we're going to be disrupting pavement to increase public access space on the roads, whether that be bike lanes or more walking lanes, you know, that's a great time to also say, let's add more tree canopy, let's add those bioretention basins, let's add bioswales, let's add native plantings to that. And that can help us all to extend our dollars a little further to, you know, carry out a more comprehensive vision for, you know, the town. And Chestertown really has an opportunity to become a roadmap for other historic towns on the Eastern Shore and preparing for climate change.
Well, Annie, we could talk about this hopefully all day long, but we're going to end here. Thank you so much for your time and good luck and congratulations on your new position.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks very much.
The Eastern Shore Journal, produced in cooperation with Hometown Multimedia.
Thank you for joining us today. I would like to thank Brian Moore and Leslie C. at WCTR for their help and support in creating this podcast, and offer special thanks to Pat Haley, my producer, for all of his hard work getting these episodes published to you. The views presented here are my own.